Welcome to We Are Chaffee's Looking Upstream, a conversational podcast of community, humanness, and well-being, rooted in Chaffee County, Colorado. I'm Adam Williams. Today I'm talking with Julie Speer Jackson, the Emmy Award-winning documentary filmmaker who directed and produced A Home in Paradise, a homegrown documentary that highlights the housing crisis and behavioral health challenges and the impacts of the socioeconomic divide right here in Chaffee County. We recorded this conversation with a live audience at the Steam Plant Theater during the Salida Film Festival, where Home in Paradise premiered last month. Julie is an incredibly prolific creator. As you'll hear me gush about in the conversation, she's received dozens of awards for her work as a director and producer, and that includes a number of Emmy Awards, 20-plus Telly Awards, and others. She's also been referred to as the Ken Burns of Colorado. In this conversation, Julie shares how she went from studying biochemistry, in French no less, while a student in Brussels, Belgium, to theater and eventually a career in filmmaking. We talk about her innovative approach to making documentaries. She calls it DocuReach, as in documentary and outreach. It's a model for social change that makes filmmaking a team sport, so to speak, rather than an ego-driven, command and control kind of endeavor. We talk about the evolution of technology throughout her career, too. From DigiBeta to the role of the internet and YouTube and TikTok, to her becoming an FAA-licensed drone pilot, and her feelings on the use of AI, artificial intelligence. We also get into the essence of Julie as a filmmaker, what storytelling is all about for her, and the million-dollar question of how to rise above the noise in a world where we all hold the creative capabilities of a content studio in the palm of our hands. The Looking Upstream podcast is supported by Chaffee County Public Health and the Chaffee Housing Authority. Show notes with links and a full transcript of this and all Looking Upstream conversations are available at wearechaffee.org. Okay, let's do this with Julie Speer Jackson.
So I want to get into your initial interest about documentary filmmaking, and I'm going to do it this way. Do you recall the 90s sitcom, Mad About You, starring Paul Reiser and Helen Hunt?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah? Okay. It was set in New York City, and Paul Reiser's character was a documentary filmmaker. Now, I was a teenager in the Midwest, far from New York, far from such concepts, and I had no idea how anybody could ever become a documentary filmmaker. How would you make a life of this? How would you make a living? Who would pay you to do such amazing, cool things? And you are that person who has made a life of doing that. So my question to you is, how were you initially sparked into this idea, wow, I want to do this? And then how did you have the belief, unlike me, that that was possible for a career in life?
That is such a great question. First of all, I remember that show, but I had no recollection that he was a documentary filmmaker. I just remember the rom-com, like the love between the two, because yeah. I love rom-coms. So that's crazy that you remember that. The way that I got into this is I really wanted to make movies, but you really can't make a low-budget movie. But you can make a really low-budget documentary, and then it'll fly. So it kind of started out that way, that it was just easier to make a low-budget documentary. And I did, ironically, go see Ken Burns. I'm talking like 1999. I saw Ken Burns speaking in Denver, and he said, documentary is what is. It's like it's better than fiction, you know, how truth is stranger than fiction, and it's so true. And so he kind of placed that in me, and I've, you know, working at PBS, I actually got to meet him, and he's great. So anyway, we started off doing documentaries because it was easier to do a low-budget doc.
I'm curious how you got to filmmaking, because I know that in college, which you went to in Brussels, Belgium, and you studied international affairs and economics, right?
Yep.
How do you transition from that into filmmaking?
Yeah, nobody told, okay, I grew up with that mentality of starving artist. You know, if you're an artist, you're never gonna make any money. So I didn't even consider studying film. I didn't consider studying anything artistic. I was actually going to be a lawyer, and then I was going to be a doctor, and I actually studied pre-med the first semester in Brussels, Belgium, in French, and I felt so stupid, because in Belgium, they let everybody in the first year, and then they make it so hard so that they kind of cut the riffraff, right?
Okay.
So once you make it to year two, it's easier. So it's like biochemistry in French. It was awful.
I would have felt stupid with it in English.
Oh, right?
Like yeah. Those are subjects that I can't tackle in English very well.
Oh.
So I think it's very impressive that you had the fluency in French to do any of it.
No, I didn't. I didn't. It was pretty bad. No,
is that where you realized you didn't?
No, well, I am fluent in French, and I lived in Belgium for 7 years. But speaking and communicating is very different than biochemistry. But although it's Latin languages, right? So it's very similar, even in English. Anyway, we could go down the rabbit hole of this. But anyway, back to what were we even talking about?
We're talking about how you got started with filmmaking, what sparked that interest, and then how you believed that that was a possible path
jump,
for you.
The jump, right. So I studied international affairs and economics. I wanted to be a doctor. Thank you, back on track. Wanted to be a doctor. That first semester was so awful that I switched to, I need to study in English. And there is a school, part of the Flemish-speaking university called Vesalius College, and it was in English. And I was like, hallelujah, I can stay in Belgium and study in English. Brussels is like the capital of the EU. There's all these expats there, and it's an economics school. So of course, and I was pre-med that second semester, but it was boring, and whereas the economics classes were like fascinating, and so I was like, okay, I'll study economics. But
it's another subject that goes over me, but okay, I'll trust you. It was fascinating.
Well, economics is basically psychology of markets and why people buy and sell and how the market reacts to things. It's really cool. Anyway.
Actually, the way you just explained it now makes me think it is cool. If somebody would have done that for me in college, then I might have taken more to it.
Yeah. Well, so I did that, but while I was there at this liberal arts school learning all about international, you know, affairs and international business, I started a theater company. And so I wrote and directed several one-act plays, did a lot of improv shows, and so I feel like I kind of got like a minor in theater without actually having a piece of paper.
Okay.
And so I moved back to the U.S. I moved to San Francisco. I started the U.S. branch of a Belgian market research firm. So again, international business. And I joined an acting troupe because I used to love being on the stage and acting. And anyway, that acting troupe, they are all like, let's go audition for this commercial. I auditioned for the commercial. I got the part. And I was like, what is this magic with these cameras and things? And the next job that I did for that that director, I was in it, but I was also his assistant director. And then once I was behind a camera, I was totally hooked.
I know you've met Ken Burns, and it seemed like you take positively to that comparison. But I wanted to ask how you feel about being the Ken Burns of Colorado versus him being the Julie Spear Jackson of wherever he is.
Snap. Love that. Let's manifest that. That'd be great.
I wonder if that has anything to do with how prolific you are. Like I mentioned beforehand, I am just blown away by this. If anybody looks at your websites, they will see that you have made 1,000+ films. And then I found out from you before we got started here, you actually stopped counting around 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
The math on that, just the 1,000, I'm going to do some real quick math. That's 20 years of 50 films per year. That's like pulling off one a week for 20 straight years.
Oh,
and you've
damn.
Done way more than that. So as a creator myself in various forms, that just blows my mind.
Wow. That's great math. Wow. That's crazy. One a week. Well, okay. So to qualify, I'm counting, you know, if somebody hires me to do a 3-minute video, I'm counting that too. Not only the, you know, feature-length documentaries.
It would be amazing if every one of those was 3 minutes and you still did it. Because people might think less of that now in the sense of how long it is because of things like Instagram and TikTok and something of this day. And everybody has a phone and everybody has a camera and they can put out videos. But they're not the produced versions of whatever you do. So 3 minutes from you to me is like poetry from somebody else, where you're distilling down with quality in a way that's just not the same. So if you did 1,000 and we know plus 15 years and they were all 3 minutes, I am still on board for mind blown. It's just incredible to me. And I wonder how you look at being so prolific and what it is that drives that for you. If that's a word that you use for yourself or you take pride in or you've aimed for.
Wow. No, I did not aim for that. I just love stories. And I love meeting people. And it's a really cool medium, if you think about it. Like, I mean, so far, any story that I'm telling, people want to be involved with it. And like, and it's always like just me being curious. And like, I wanted to go inside Cheyenne Mountain. Like, I wanted to go see where War Games, you know, was kind of based on.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I was like, okay, I'll do a show on that just so I could go in there, you know. And people are so generous and so open-hearted when you're coming with, well, it used to be $100,000 worth of equipment. I mean, now I can go with my phone, and it's 8K, which I did start filming a documentary in New Orleans with our phones because it's amazing and you can. But people are very generous, and when you come with equipment and you want to do their story, most of the time they're really excited about it. So, and I will also say it's a team sport. Like, filmmaking is very collaborative. You know, you have the camera person, you have writers, composers. I mean, it's all these different art forms kind of coming together in a video story. So I haven't done it all by myself, is what I mean.
Sure. The fact that people say yes, I have said this before about podcasting, that when you ask people, they often will say yes. They understand there's a purpose. And I think that people want to share their stories.
Yeah.
They just need somebody to ask who's willing to actually listen.
Totally. And everybody has a story. Like, everybody has a story. Even if people don't think they have a story, they have a story.
Yeah, yeah. You went into NORAD, we're talking about, right, for Cheyenne Mountain. Is that right? So there wasn't red tape. They also...
Oh, there's tons of red tape.
And
not
that's,
as
and...
much red tape as the Olympics. That is so much red tape. Like, we
don't
do that story. But
yeah,
but they... Okay, this was being on staff with PBS, like, for 10 years. PBS, there's a certain cachet, right? So if it's like, hey, NORAD marketing department, we want to, like, I don't even remember how the heck... I have to kind of go back. That was probably 10 years ago.
Like, I didn't know they'd have a marketing department.
Well, I'm kind of making that up. I don't know.
I gotcha.
Who did we call? I don't even remember. But I ended up meeting, like, you know, Five Star General. And but my point is that when you call, and, you know, I'm calling from Rocky Mountain PBS, and I'm doing a show, Colorado Experience, we'd love to profile this subject. They're like, wow, that's great, you know?
Yeah, it opens doors when you show an interest, a sincere interest.
Well, and if it's going to air on PBS, it's like... Well,
I'm sure that helps.
Yeah.
How many films would you say you have in production at any given time? At whatever phase they're in? Because, again, with the thread of prolificity here, I'm trying... It's just this math still. It boggles my mind. And how you keep it all straight as you're going.
Yeah. Well, it depends on if it's like an original content project that we're developing on our own or if it's something people are paying us to do. So, you know, I've had upwards of 20, 25 projects in production because people, you know, are paying us to do it. And so they're all at different phases. And right now I have 7 projects that I am actively developing.
I'm speechless because those numbers are multiples of what I thought your answer might be. I thought you might say, 4 or 5. That's a lot.
Yeah.
I don't know how you keep it all straight in your mind or on a schedule.
Well,
Where am I supposed to be today?
Yeah, but you don't, like story-wise, you don't mix up Hansel and Gretel and Little Red Riding Hood. I mean, that story's that story, and that story's that story. It's very easy to keep them separate. And I also am like, yeah, I can switch gears really quickly, too. Like, I can be editing something and then totally switch gears and meet about a different project because it's a different project and it's different people and...
You have a particular model for how you go about some of these things. And I'm going to reference A Home in Paradise, which is the homegrown Chaffee County-based documentary that premiered here. That was an example of you working with a creative committee mm-hmm. in order to produce this thing. But that's a model that you apply, I think, a lot, right?
Yeah.
That's kind of your go-to.
That is my model, yeah.
Well, you describe that, and and why you do that, because one of my first thoughts is, isn't that getting a lot of cooks in the kitchen? Doesn't that make it cumbersome for you to keep this one film going when you're having so many different voices and you're doing it across so many films like you just numbered?
Mm-hmm. Well, so in 2001, this model, so we call it DocuReach, so Documentary Film and Outreach, this model won a Denver Business Journal's Most Innovative New Product, because back then, I mean, there weren't a lot of documentaries, you know, and this is like before participant films, like it's kind of normal now that you have action, social action with a documentary film, but back then there wasn't. And over the last 20 years, it's sort of, the process has really honed in to be, yes, it's storytelling by committee, but it makes it easier for me if I'm working with a team of people who are really involved and invested in whatever that subject matter is. They know it in a way that I don't. So it's sort of like, you know, community brain trust. Like, you come in with all this brain power already. I don't have to come figure it all out by myself. So it actually makes it easier. And then I feel like if you look at Home in Paradise, like, it was a pretty cool process. So there was, I don't know, 25-ish people in a room that I led them through the process, where we kind of all got aligned of, okay, what is the biggest public health issue in Chaffee County? And it was very clear it was housing, behavioral health, and then transportation and aging were like the top four of like 20 different issues. And because we all came up with that together, everybody was sort of bought in on, okay, this is the story. And now let's find interviewees. And it's really like activating and mobilizing community members to participate in a story. And then, like, what's really cool about the process, so like in Aurora, for example, the documentary is called America's Hidden Gem, and it's on Northwest Aurora, which anyone who is in Denver is always like, oh, you know, Aurora, and it's poor, and it's like, it doesn't have a really good reputation, and we're really trying to change that. But just the process of having the steering committee has benefited the community in a way, because people who wouldn't normally work together are now working together on the story. So the process of filmmaking is actually social change in a way. And then I have people to bounce ideas off of, find interviewees, they review the cut. And like, most directors come in and they're like, do it my way. And my way is like, let's do it with everybody. And then the steering committee and the people who are involved use the film. Like, and they'll use it for years. And whereas I'm on to the next thing, which is what's great.
You were commenting on how that was noted as innovative in 2001. Mm-hmm. Is that model still extraordinary? Do you know other directors who at all try to do what you do?
I don't work with other directors, so I don't really know. But I think it's more normal just for the director to come in and be the boss of it all.
Other than the ways you described about how it actually helps you, I mean, you get those people in a room and they can say, well, here are all these potential sources and subjects, right? Mm-hmm. That can be helpful when you're not from that community. But I'm wondering what other reasons you might have that motivate you in that human outreach sense. Why is it you've decided this is the model that you really want to do from that standpoint of how this does get carried on even when you move forward with other projects?
Well, it just works. I don't know. And it I feel like it makes the projects more resilient, you know, and more authentic.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah. How do you choose projects? If people come to you and they want to hire you, how do you decide what to say yes to? What is the nugget that has to be there for you to say, yes, this is a story that I feel something for?
That's a great question. I don't know that I've ever turned away a story. Like, I you know, my work speaks for itself. So the people who come to me are people who resonate with my style and vibe anyway. I have a lot of repeat clients, you know, that I've been working with. There's one law firm in Denver that I've worked with for, you know, 15 years. And so it just depends on, I don't know, if they come to me, mostly I say yes. I don't know that I've ever said no.
Okay.
But also, this is documentary. It's very different. I'm about to do my first feature film, you know, with actors, and I am the director, and I wrote the script, so maybe it is my way on this one, you know. We'll see.
Are you concerned at all about the learning curve for that, the transition from one style to another?
Yes. It's like I'm that kid again in the biology class in French. Like, what's happening? You know, people name drop with me all the time, like actors' names and directors' names. I don't know who anybody is. And I'm always like, people who know me, I'm like, please don't name drop with me. And if you name drop, say that, oh, that's a famous actor, that's a famous director, this is someone, you know.
Give you context.
I just don't know. So there's that part that I just don't know who's who. But filmmaking is filmmaking. You know, there's still a camera and lights and editing. Like, process, I think, is largely the same. It's just it's a lot bigger budgets. So that's new.
You have interviewed, I would think, easily thousands, maybe several thousand, maybe more.
Maybe
right?
Tens of thousands, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Over the years. That is a lot of observation about people, their behaviors, how they act when they get in front of a camera, in front of a microphone, what they're willing to share, what they're not willing to share, and just plain learning from their stories.
Mm-hmm.
When they open up and they're actually vulnerable and they share real things. So I'm curious what you have learned in the process of spending so much time getting intimate in these conversations with so many people.
And it honestly, that's my favorite part, is filming. And those interviews are like my favorite part. And yeah, I've learned all kinds of little tricks. But number one is look people in the eyes. Because then if you're looking them in the eyes, then their level of vulnerability and trust is like already a lot higher. Because boom, human, I see you. You know? And I think it's just, I genuinely listen with curiosity. And so when you're really present and listening, people share because they're like, oh, you really do want to know. And it used to be that, like, if someone cried, I felt very like, yeah, I made him cry. Like, but now it's like, I don't know. It's like, that's, to me, it's sort of normal. My job as the interviewer, I'd be curious to see what your job is, how you see it. But like, for me, my job is to create literally a safe environment. So I kind of imagine like a bubble. And if someone is feeling, like I can feel if they're nervous. And then so my job is to be so calm. And like I literally will breathe out their nervousness, if that makes sense. It's just like holding space for them to feel safe.
I definitely understand that, and I think that we might go about it differently. You can tell me if I'm wrong, and because I'm guessing about the way your job functions versus the way I handle, say, this podcast. In general, what I do with people is we get into deep and vulnerable spaces when that's what they have in their story, and to help them feel safe, part of what I do is speak on my story, because to me, that's showing them the distance we can go with this. Where are the boundaries or not, so to speak? I want them to feel safe, like they're not the only ones that are going out on that branch. Mm-hmm. You know, they're not exposed and in the hot seat, and I'm sitting back protected and safe because I don't have to share anything. I'm the one asking the questions, right? So I will often answer the unasked question. I will share my own vulnerability in order to entice them into knowing. Actually, I don't think that's the right word. That feels negative to me. I want them to feel safe. And I think that by knowing they're safe with me because I've shared something of myself. Whereas for you behind the camera, I'm guessing it's not so much you sharing you with them. And
totally.
You still get them to share their vulnerability.
To be honest, people like don't know about me because they don't ask and I don't tell. So it's, yeah, our methods are very different. So my method is just to 100% be with them in the moment. And it's like a cathartic process for them in a lot of ways. And there's a lot of emotion and then there's hopefully healing. And then I'm just in it with them. If that makes sense.
Are you a reflective sort of person that when somebody is sharing from those vulnerable places with you, even though you're not sharing it back to them, is it stirring things? Do you go home at the end of that day and you're thinking about whatever your life things are for over the years that you've, you know, might be trying to resolve within yourself?
So no, but that's because I've been doing it for 20 years. Like I used to, yes. And now when I'm in the moment, I'm like in the moment. And if like there's one amazing moment that I remember, there's a woman who grew up Native American, a Ute woman who grew up in boarding schools. And she was telling me the story and, you know, it was very painful reliving it. And I literally like apologized to her you know, I'm a white woman, and I apologize for what happened, and we are crying and hugging, and it was a beautiful moment of, like, sharing and healing, and then it was done. But I remember it, but I processed it in the moment, right? But one of my first films when I was much younger was called Haiti's Small Miracles, and I went to the island of Haiti, and man, this is like the worst slum in the Western Hemisphere. The poverty is like next level. And I came back and I literally wept in the grocery store because we have an aisle for cereal. And like I had just been with people who don't know what they're gonna eat, right? Like it's, so I was kind of a wreck for a couple of months. Like just the guilt of what we have in America, and like I was heavy with what I saw. But then I realized, like, if I don't release that, I'm gonna be no good to the story. I won't, like, what good am I if I'm just stuck in the heaviness of the emotion? So part of my job became experience. One woman that I am doing a film with called me the witness. Like, I witness, and then I, you know, put the story together, capture the light of it all, and share it.
Kind of the conduit for the story, you know, exactly. As the storyteller. But I see, you know, from my seat here as a facilitator between you or whoever is the guest of any given podcast conversation with anyone who ever listens after this, right? And you serve as that conduit for very meaningful stories. So I understand what you're saying about how upsetting that was to come back in the abundance that we have and so many of us take for granted. And there are people who are in such dire straits that there's a disconnect. But for you to tell that story is the way to shine light on what needs to be, right?
Exactly.
I've heard you refer to yourself, or the word, I should say, as a light worker, as working with light, because it actually functionally factors into the medium of photography, of videography, of, you know, these things that work for television and film. But there's also, for lack of a different word coming to mind, sort of the spiritual essential sense of light and light work. Would you care to speak to that?
Yeah.
To any and all of that.
Yeah, and that is, I feel like you've just nailed my essence right there. Like that I feel like my purpose on this planet is to see the beauty of what is happening. Yes, a lot of the issues are placed within kind of the evil and ugliness of humanity, but it's to capture what's working, capture the beauty, and then share it out so that people are healed, so that people can feel something, learn something, and then hopefully be a part of like a positive change. So it is very much to connect humanity. That is my personal mission, is to connect humanity with this medium, which is, as you pointed out, literally transmitting light. It's like capturing and transmitting light. It's powerful stuff, I will say. It's like, yeah, it's pretty cool. I'm very blessed. And now I'm hoping to do it more, bigger.
You've said that this medium is fundamental to who you are, and I wonder how that is different for you compared to back when you were starting with theater or some other way of expressing yourself. I mean, I used the word poetry earlier. You could have been a poet, you could be an actor, you could be so many things that still touch people's hearts, still help as a conduit for good in their lives. What is it about this medium of film in particular that really is fundamental to who you are and how you communicate?
I do paint as well, and I love poetry, so I feel like an artist is an artist, right?
I think so.
But this medium specifically, I mean, I used to be very purist. Oh, theater is the only true form of, you know, I was kind of like a performing arts snob, like when I was like really young, like late teens, early 20s. And then this crazy thing called the internet kind of came out, and it was like, wait a minute, like you can share the same story on the internet millions and millions and millions of times, and it's like, this is super powerful as a medium. This is the most powerful medium of today, like bar none, the most powerful medium. So it's like, okay, what are you gonna do with it, you know? And you, for me, it's about love and positivity and truth.
Speaking of the internet, I wanted to be able to talk about this evolution of technology in the field, in your career, because you happen to be at a time where you started with what I assume was still film, if you were toward the end of that, before going into digital.
It was DigiBeta.
Okay. Then what we've done here, though, is the internet has come along. Then we've got YouTube. We've got iPhones. All these technologies, like we've talked about, you can pull out your phone and create something amazing from it. All the way up here to flying cameras. You are
AI.
An FAA licensed drone pilot and AI, right? Artificial intelligence.
Yeah.
The evolution of your career
crazy.
Technologically is. It's
crazy. You guys, the first cameras that when I entered this field, it was documentary, so we didn't have the budgets for film, but most people were still filming on film. I remember going to Sundance and there was this whole the digital revolution, and Star Wars was going to be shot on digital, and everyone was like, what? So the first films that we did, the cameramen had to be men because the cameras were stupidly heavy and big. And that's why it had to be $100,000 worth of equipment, because it was just expensive and big. And so I saw the cameras come down to when I could actually film, because I could hold a steady shot. And it was a Sony FS7. It was yay big. And now, on my phone. So just the cameras, it's insane to me. It's 8K. My phone shoots 8K. And there's there's five lenses on this camera, which is this is the best camera, or phone camera. So the cameras are, amazing change of technology. Oh, and the hard drive space. My first film, the Haiti film, Haiti Small Miracles, our hard drive was 800 gigabytes. And it was this big. And we were oh my God, it's digital, and we're gonna put in this big thing. And now it's the SD drives that are this big, that are 10 terabytes. It's crazy.
The size of your thumb?
It's crazy. I love it. I love it, I love it, I love it. And now with AI in my industry, everybody's freaking out because AI is totally, I dream of the day where I can upload my script and AI just spits it back. Here it is, the video.
You could get a script spit back to you right now if you wanted to put in a prompt for something, right?
I mean,
are these tools that you envision using in a positive way, or are you also freaking out about it?
So when it first started, I was freaking out. It's the Terminator, and it's the beginning of the end. But I am more of a Star Trek kind of person. Trekkies are the utopia of the planet, the alignment of all of the species and the Federation. If you think about it, they're using technology all the time for good. And I think for me, it's always fundamentally, what are you going to do with it? What's your purpose? And I am not a Hollywood studio. I am not replacing, hundreds of people's jobs with AI, because I employ, in Home in Paradise, there was under 10 of us, working on that. So, but I didn't use AI on any part of that because we didn't really need to. I'm not afraid of the technology now. I'm actually really curious about it, and I'm starting to use it. So we use AI for script reviews. You pop a script, and then you literally in 5 minutes get this complete coverage, and it gives you really good feedback. And you can get it to write scenes, which is kind of freaky, but you still need a human to discern the story. And you also have to check AI, GPT chat. Sometimes it just makes stuff up. And it's you can't assume that it's true, which is crazy to me.
When you ask it for feedback, what are the kinds of prompts you're using for that? How are you trying to elicit feedback from it, or what kind of feedback?
Okay, so with White Prairie, this is the script that I'm working on now. I put it in, and I get a grade. So my goal is to get a 9 out of 10. That's my goal with it. I have an 8 right now. For example, the feedback on this from the AI is, you need more drama between the bus driver and the teacher. And then I can ask it, what kind of drama? And then you can actually, it literally talks to you. And then And I can ask it, what line would you suggest? Okay, to be very clear, I did not put any of that into the script, but it was really fun to kind of play with it and see what it says. But I've let it kind of distill, and now within the next month, I'm going to go back and do a rewrite. But it's kind of been in my mind, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Let's step back in technology to the old days of when YouTube and Instagram and things were invented versus AI, right?
Like, yeah, which I remember the first, when YouTube first came out, like, that's how old I am. Like, I was doing exports before YouTube, and the first one that we could put on YouTube is so small now. It's still on YouTube, but it's like so small and pixelated because that was the biggest format you could import at that time. And now it's like HD.
Right.
It's
right,
crazy.
Right. What I'm wondering about that is how, again, it's made it so democratic and so ubiquitous that anybody can make a film. They can put it on YouTube, have distribution. They can put it on TikTok and promote. They can do all these things. I'm curious how the evolution of all of this has affected you, your mindset as one, you're probably having to keep learning if you want to keep going with it, but also if you feel like there's a negative impact on you at all by the evolution of all of this, because it does it saturate, you know, content production? Everybody is a content producer or can be, and they have the tool right there with their phone for audio, video, stills, everything.
That's the million-dollar question right there. Like, yeah, when I was young, there was literally four channels, and it turned off at midnight, and it was the waving flag.
I only had three channels.
Okay, three. Well, ABC, NBC, CBS, PBS. Okay, four.
I don't know that I got so many. We had rabbit ears. I lived in rural northern Missouri. We didn't have anything. It was a big deal when we finally got the cable box that would set up on top of the TV, and you'd have to walk up to it because it wouldn't work with the remote and click down on the thing to watch MTV when I was in high school.
Yeah, we had to get up and turn the dial. And there
was
12.
Yeah, yeah. 2 to 13. Yeah, so 12 channels.
Okay, so I started with four. But yeah, so everybody was watching the same thing.
Right, yeah.
You know, it was very focused. And now, thousands.
We're drowning in content.
No, there's so much content. So the question now is, how do you rise above the noise? And well, in Hollywood, it's all, you get the biggest, you know, celebrity you can. How do you rise above the noise? I still believe it's about story, and a good story is going to rise above. I mean, I'm, you know, maybe very optimistic about that. So it's always story, good story. I haven't had a negative impact on that because I'm very democratic. I love the idea of self-distribution, which is what is happening now in my industry. So I'm actually really excited about it. We'll see how it all unfolds.
I think it doesn't do us any good not to be optimistic. I suppose that's one look, right? We need to be optimistic if we're going to keep on with our work. And keep trying to shine the good, and we reach who we reach.
Yeah.
It's far more distributed now than, like you said, when we only had a few networks and everybody watched all the same things. Those days are gone.
They're totally gone. And there's no barrier between me and audience, between any content creator and audience. So that actually, I mean, if I had a crystal ball to predict the future, I think that creators will have direct connection to audience, and they're, I think in the short term there will be an aggregator, say it's Amazon is aggregating for the audience, but long term the audience will just go directly to the creator. I think
it continues evolving so quickly.
It's so fast. It's just who knows?
At the heart of it is story. And like you mentioned, that ultimately, despite the heavier things, like in Haiti that you cover, and it ultimately is about, can come to joy and love and those sorts of things, a word that often comes up for me is resilience. Mm-hmm. And that by getting into the vulnerable of people's stories, what we're doing, whether it's film or audio, whatever, is following the hero's journey. That the arc of, you have to have, you know, the hero face some sort of challenge, and there's darkness, and then how did they overcome this? And there's resilience to go through it and have joy and come to love and the light and all these sorts of things. Mm-hmm. So I think the essence of that is in all of us as humans, and as long as we exist, that's going to be there, and that's part of it.
Totally. And it's about feeling. It's literally about emotions. It's like, that's why people watch stories, is to feel something, is to learn something.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's why there's, you know, such a hunger for horror films, which is so not my genre. I'm more of a rom-com sci-fi kind of gal, and documentaries, of course. But I think people love horror films because they want to feel something. They want to, right now, I think humanity is so kind of disconnected from their authentic, each human disconnected from their authentic self, that they need that outside stimulus to feel something. So I'm all about, okay, but remember who you are. See the good. Be in your body, be in the moment, and participate. And it's, I don't know, it's like, let's just all wake up.
If we are disconnected from the authenticity within our individual selves, then how can we possibly have better connection with others, right? Which is, I think, the state of the world right now. And what we're feeling is a lot of disconnection and anxiety around it.
Thank you. And when someone is their authentic self, that inspires and makes it safe for other people to be their authentic self, which is the beauty of documentary. People show up and they're like, this is me, this is who I am. And the viewer feels that, right? People feel that when they're watching the documentary, and then they can show up as their authentic self.
I feel like when people are watching or listening to other stories that are being shared so openly, maybe it's a raw something, it's vulnerable, and there's just full of humanity, that it's not as much that they are connecting with that person in terms of all in, focused on their story as much as what they feel, and then it brings to mind for their story. Like if I see something that might remind me of something with one of my parents, something in my childhood, whatever, I start going mentally down that rabbit hole of my own story, and that's how I feel connected to that person, not the specifics of what
totally.
Their lived experience has
totally.
Been.
Totally. It's how it makes you feel. Totally.
Yeah. So let's talk about success. And as part of that, failure, right? You've obviously had a lot of success. I started off with all the awards, this incredible lengthy list of dozens of awards that you have received for your work. And that oftentimes gets looked at as success, mm-hmm. and fairly enough. But any creator, surely, or any human really in their own lane of life is going to experience failure along the way. So I'm curious what you have to speak to that, the idea of failure as part of your path to whatever you determined is success for you in this field.
Mm. Kind of where I'm at right now is that, yeah, the awards are outside validation, which I feel like I have insecurity, part of the journey of being a female in America. Like I have constantly felt not good enough and just insecure. And so the outside validation in form of awards has been very affirming for me. Where I'm at in my career now is that I need to stop needing the outside validation. It's like the success is internal, if that makes sense. That's kind of where I'm at this moment.
It does make sense. What I'm wondering is how you might define that internally. What is that intrinsic sense of reward or success or accomplishment just within yourself, measured only against yourself?
Yeah, it's just it's the feeling. It's all feeling, and it's all the emotional grounding, which I have very much with documentary production and documentary work. And it's that newness of the narrative space that I get, have the anxiety that's familiar from 20 years ago, But failure to me is part of learning. It's kind of like my husband pointed this out with golf. Like we learned how to golf, and I would get mad, he's like, why are you getting mad? Like, and it's like, wait, good point. It's like how you play the game. So that's, I've had lots of failures. I mean,
is there anything coming to mind specifically that you care to share as one of those challenges? Or to me, when we're saying failure, I feel like we need to put air quotes on it too, because of the fact that when it's part of the process and when it's part of the learning, it's not, in my mind, actually failure. It might feel like it in the moment, especially if it was something related to an award or something like that that you felt like you wanted for your validation in the industry. But in the end, whatever we learn from those moments, I think when we look back in hindsight, then we see, that's why this went this way. That's how this set me up for this success, mm-hmm. this opportunity. Mm-hmm. So failure or challenge, however you want to look at it, is there one that specifically, maybe early in your career, where you learned a particular lesson that you have carried with you for the years since in how you produce your work?
Wow, that's a really good question. I think for me, a lot of it is, it's mindset. And I also believe everything happens for a reason, like what you just said, like, oh, that happened, and so this happened because of that. So I do sort of trust that, you know, it's the spiritual kind of anchor again, that things happen for a reason. But it's like, what is failure? Like, my first film is really terrible, and I was acting in it, and I was murdered, and there's like, it's just bad, bad. It's like a good B movie that, you know. But is it a failure? I don't think so.
Were you excited about it at the time?
I was so excited about it. Because first I was acting in it. And then I quickly became a part of the camera department because it was like one guy. And so we needed a two shot. I was literally hanging off the side of a cliff in like Northern California filming. It was so fun. I mean, it was so fun. It was so crazy and probably very dangerous, but it was really fun. It's a terrible movie. I mean, sorry to the people who created it. It's, you know, it's a really good B movie, but I don't see it as a failure because it was a growth process. It was a learning process. And at the time, I was so proud of that thing.
I think that's a really key piece of our process of understanding of what failure and success is. When you were younger and that's where you were in your career and it was so amazing and it was fun and that was a success in many ways. So to look back in hindsight without the grace of, but that's where I was then, right? So it's interesting how the definitions of those things, success and failure, can shift. Just like success for you included awards for a while, as it is for all of us. And at some point then we reach a place where we're like, but those accolades aren't what really sustains me in this now? What is my why for doing this now?
Totally. It's funny, I'm thinking about like, when I was a kid, I was a straight A student, and I remember crying when I got a B. Because I, you know, I'm that overachiever, and you know what I got a B in? Was PE. I was so like, I was so mad at her. Anyway, I have this whole vision of that moment. But fast forward to probably like 6 years ago, the hardest thing I had done in a really long time was get my FAA drone license. And it's like math and science and all the things. And I was so nervous about this test. And I got a 71. And I was like, yes, a C. I was like, I was so excited because I passed, right? So it's just even, and I remember in that moment laughing at myself at how my, you know, 15-year-old self would have been devastated by that C. But my adult self was so thrilled that I got my license and the C was just perfect.
Perspective is so funny.
Yeah.
Let's wrap with this. You are prolific. I have talked about this because I find that so impressive. And I say that with as the utmost compliment to you. So I know you have work ahead. What's next? What are you about to go do? What are you already in the process of?
Well, I'm hoping to transition into the narrative space, and I have a feature film, my first one that I've written, and I'm probably going to direct unless, you know, somebody really, really famous wants to act and direct in it. I'm totally open to that. And then I have a few series that I'm going to produce, and hopefully one of them will be right here in Salida and Chaffee County, because I feel like narrative stories have a bigger audience and a bigger reach than documentaries. I mean, there are some documentaries, of course, that reach the planet, and I'll try to do one of those, too.
You mentioned Ken Burns saying that documentary, I don't remember the exact wording of this, but basically documentary shows what is.
It is, you know, what is, that's what he said, yeah.
So when we're talking about truth in fiction, through that narrative sort of filmmaking you're talking about, how do you see that? How do you see the value of being able to show what is through those fictional representations of story?
Well, White Prairie is it's inspired by a true story of why school buses are painted that yellow-orange. And it's a true story of my great aunt Clara and 20 kids and a bus driver who were stranded on a blizzard in 1931. So it is truth in what happened. And then it's actually really exciting to me. Like, we can't go interview Clara because she's passed. Everybody who was on the bus, they're gone. So we get to recreate them. And then it's, you know, having the emotional authenticity with the actors portraying them. And I mean, we get to make it with, you know, visual effects and computer generated graphics of the blizzard and the snow. And it's pretty cool that we get to do that. Like, we couldn't do that as, well, I did do a documentary on it, and you have photographs and you have historians, but it's not a first-person account, so it's actually really cool to be able to use narrative as a first-person account and then have that emotional sharing.
Do you find there's freedom in being able, as a creator, to use fiction to get to that emotional place in telling that story, that sense of truth in fiction? Are you looking forward to the freedom of being able to work with fiction?
You know what I'm so excited about right now is writing fiction now, that there's no budget limitation on paper. Like, that is what I'm really excited about. It's like, what does my imagination have? Like, it's okay, whatever it is, it doesn't matter. Put it on the page. Like, that is really freeing to me. I'm really excited about that.
This has been great to talk with you, Julie. Thank you very much for doing this with me.
Thank you, Adam.
Thanks for listening to the We Are Chafee Looking Upstream podcast. If our conversation here today sparks curiosity for you, you can learn more in this episode's show notes at wearechafee.org. If you have comments or know someone in Chafee County, Colorado, who I should consider talking with on the podcast, you can email us at info@wearechafee.org. We invite you to rate and review the We Are Chafee Looking Upstream podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever platform you use with that functionality. We also invite you to tell others about the Looking Upstream podcast. Help us to keep growing community and connection through conversation. Once again, I'm Adam Williams, host, producer, and photographer. John Prey is engineer and producer. Thank you to KHN 106.9 FM, our community radio partner in Salida, Colorado. To Heather Gorby for graphic and web design. To Andrea Carlstrom, director of Chafee County Public Health and Environment. And to Lisa Martin, community advocacy coordinator for the We Are Chafee Storytelling Initiative. The We Are Chafee Looking Upstream podcast is a collaboration with the Chafee County Department of Public Health and the Chafee Housing Authority, and it's supported by the Colorado Public Health and Environment Office of Health Disparities. You can learn more about the Looking Upstream podcast and related storytelling initiatives at wearechafee.org and on Instagram and Facebook at wearechafee.